Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the LSE. Welcome to this hybrid event, Green, Just and Healthy. What do young Londoners want for the future of their neighbourhoods? We're here today as part of the LSE Festival, which is themed this year, Visions for the Future. And this event will be a chance to dig into what young people want for the future of the city and how we can get there. It's great to see lots of familiar faces in the audience from Islington Council, from the GLA, and lots of new faces too. Thank you all for being here, and thank you those online as well. My name is Imogen Hamilton-Jones, and I am a policy researcher at LSE Cities. I'm happy to be joined today by Manya Jones, who's a young researcher I've been working with for the past year as part of the LSE Cities Islington Council peer research project, which inspired this event. I'll tell you a bit more on that in a minute. Also, we have next to her Councillor Champion from Islington Council, who's been the executive member for environment, air quality and transport since December 2019. In that time, Islington has introduced 7 LTNs, 37 school streets, built a network of cycleways, and introduced the new livable neighbourhood scheme, which actually became the focus of our peer research project. And finally, on our panel, we have Deputy Mayor Mette Coban, who's been overseeing the Mayor's Climate Action Plan for London since July last year. Mette has long been committed to youth voice in politics. He led the youth voter registration campaign, Given X, in 2024, and he founded the youth-led charity My Life, My Say. So he's excellently placed to talk with us about how policymaking and youth political participation in the green transition meet across the capital. Before we go any further, I'd like to give you a little bit of context. This event builds on a youth-led research project, which we've been running in Islington for the past year, with 4 young people and 2 policymakers from Islington Council, who are sitting here in the front row with us. It's not an easy time to be a young person in London today. Many young people we spoke to are occupied by immediate concerns of how to make their lives in broken economic and social systems. And as we watch in dismay at global events unfolding each day, a feeling of powerlessness can easily set in. Perhaps unsurprisingly, figures for youth engagement in local politics in general and in climate politics in particular are incredibly low, despite the fact that young people arguably have the most at stake in the battle for livable cities today and a livable planet in the decades to come. So our project wanted to understand if climate action at a local level in cities can help bring diverse people together, especially young people, and empower them to engage with politics. How can the urgent task of the green transition be made relevant to their everyday lives and hopes for the future? How can the process of policymaking be opened up to include diverse groups of young people? As a team of researchers, we decided to focus particularly on Islington's Livable Neighbourhoods programme and kind of use it as an entry point for our conversations about the green transition. So we'll hear much more about Livable Neighbourhoods from Councillor Champion in a minute. But it's essentially taking quite a holistic approach to the green transition and thinking about how the borough can become a greener, fairer, healthier place for all. And part of that is reallocating street space away from cars and towards green and social space. We did interviews, focus groups, workshops with young people, mainly in the age group 16 to 26, as well as with policymakers in Islington. And we've built up what I think is a really rich picture of what young people want and what livable means to them. So it's kind of the first time that we've shared this with an audience beyond Islington Council and the young participants in our research. So it's very exciting to have you all here and a chance to exchange and hear what you think. In terms of the structure, each of our speakers are going to speak for 5 minutes. Manya's going to start us off sharing her experience of working with policymakers on green transition policy and some emerging findings from our report. And then we will hear responses from our 2 politicians. Also, 5 minutes each. I've got a colleague here who's got signs, and she'll keep waving them at the end to make sure you wrap up on time. I think that's all. I'll then, obviously, we'll move to the Q&A. I'll try and leave as much time as possible for the Q&A, but I'll start us off with a couple of questions. Please, if you're watching online, start thinking of your questions now and posting them in the chat. And we'll take questions in groups of three. So looking forward to that. I think there's a few more housekeeping items, which are the hashtag for today's event is LSE Festival, hashtag LSE Festival. And I'd ask you to please put your phones on silent so you don't disrupt the event. And the event is being recorded, so the hope is to make a podcast after this event, assuming there's no technical difficulties. Okay, I think that's everything. So, Manya, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Imogen, and thank you for everyone joining today and online. My name's Manya, and I'm one of the young researchers for this project. First, I'll tell you a bit more about why I joined this project and then the key findings from our research. So I joined this project as someone who doesn't have a scientific background in climate issues. Instead, my lived experience through studying, working, and living in the borough, combined with my studies in politics and sociology, led me to want to join this project. Another reason for joining is that I haven't seen representation of people like me who aren't experts in the traditional sense, but whose voices are still crucial to this conversation. My particular interest lies in how climate justice is related to other kinds of justice. Equity, diversity, and inclusion aren't just buzzwords for me. I think they're not so significantly integrated in climate conversations. This has become a significant theme in our research and when we've spoken to young people. Moving on to the three key findings, the first being an intersection of environmental, social, and economic justice. The second, safety as a green transition priority, and the third being a participation gap between young people and council initiatives. So moving on to the first finding. 90% of our survey respondents want the green transition to address the everyday inequalities of economic and social, everyday realities of economic and social inequalities. I've witnessed this wealth inequality firsthand. Some parts of the borough are much nicer than others. They have nicer community spaces, more green spaces, and there's less pollution compared to other parts of the borough. We've seen this disparity as well come up in our focus groups and in our research. What struck me as particularly concerning is the levels of deprivation that have remained largely consistent. Studies from 2008 and 2019 show little improvement. This really made me question, what can the green transition actually do to create tangible change for those who need it most? Moving on to the second finding, safety as a green transition priority. When we asked young people what emotion they felt moving around the borough, what came up was the feeling of unsafety being the second most common emotion, the first being neutral, which isn't great either. For young people, not feeling safe directly impacts green transition goals. Safety and accessibility concerns were particularly raised by young women and disabled respondents, who suggested like they feel safer travelling via car compared to walking or cycling due to these safety concerns. This has raised important questions about what the green transition can do to make our streets safer for everyone, not just young people. Moving on to the last finding of the participation gap. 70% of young people said they want to be more involved in local decisions. However, 39% don't know how to go about it. This suggests both an awareness and communications gap between young people and the council, which this research sought to address. During our workshops, young people generated ideas for co-design methods of participation. Young people have a lot to offer. Without being patronising, we must acknowledge that your local government can be confusing, and no single young person we met had a good sense of how it works. Physical education and upskilling could be beneficial to help young people understand how these issues directly impact them. To summarise, Young Londoners have a clear vision for the future, and we need innovations like this. and local councils and wider organisations to provide platforms, resources and most importantly long-term commitment to bringing these visions to life. The green transition isn't just about environmental outcomes, it's about creating a more just and equitable future for all of us. Thank you.
Okay, we could hear next from Rowena. I'm going to slip in two quick questions there. Firstly, what is the council's vision for the livable neighbourhood scheme and for the green transition in Islington? And how does it relate to young people's needs and desires, as we've just heard described by Manya? And also, I guess, there have been challenges to implementing livable neighbourhoods. I guess we've seen across the UK, the green transition sometimes causes division amongst communities. So what do you think the role of young people is in a context where debates can become polarised? Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you everybody for coming. I think what I'd first say is the piece of work that the LSE have done with Islington Council is actually fundamental to what we want to be doing going forward. I think, as been said before, for young people, sometimes finding a way of engaging in the process is, even using the word process, I think, is probably unhelpful. It's really difficult, and there are quite a lot of barriers to it. I mean, but for us, actually, it is to create a truly equal Islington, where everybody feels comfortable in their streets, that they're rooted in their own communities. Having young people feed in and being part of that, and feeling part of that, is so fundamentally important. So we started talking about what the Livable Neighbourhood Programme is. I think, if I'm fair, when we started, we look at it more as what we actually started off in COVID with the LTNs, which is simply a traffic scheme. It creates space by taking traffic out. And we know that over the last probably decades, people have been pushed out of their streets, essentially by cars. You know, pedestrians are now on the pavements, whereas before, you know, if you go back sort of like in the last century, you'd see people just mingling. That it would be a community space where people got together and people mingled. And over time, traffic has dominated these spaces. I mean, even so, you know, when we talk about things like school streets, we talk about livable neighbourhoods to people. You have conversations about, well, we'd like to create spaces for children to play. And they'll say, why? They've got playgrounds. We are locking people into spaces rather than allowing people to be part of those spaces. And for us, livable neighbourhoods and that transition is really, really important. And of course, that can't take place if we have a whole section of our community who don't feel not only just part of something, but feel that sometimes they're not even people don't want them to be part of something. So we know that young people can just talking to their friends, get together, actually, and people see them as a threat. And I think what we need to be doing is changing that. And actually, if we don't, then we are much poorer for it. So the Livable Neighbourhood Programme for us is very much about how you create that space, but also, you create that space, but then how do you create the communities that come into that space and want to use that space? Because that's actually the key. Now, in Islington, it's really important that we change our streets. We have got so much concrete, you know, we've got so little green space. And actually, from a climate point of view, we have to change that because we know the heat island effects. We know that there's flooding, you know, and they are impacted on people. And as we know, it's not impacted on everybody fairly. It's going to be the same people are always impacted by problems. It's the younger people, older people, people with certain health conditions. So actually, tackling the climate crisis is about social justice. But also we can do it in a way that makes our own community, that makes Islington fairer and more equal. And that's what we're determined to do. We have tried to engage young people. So when we go out to livable neighbourhood consultations or school street consultations, it's easy for us to go into the schools. You know, it's easier for us to go into youth hubs and things like that. But what is not easier for us to do is actually to hear the voices of those people who are not in those spaces. And that's why this piece of work for us is so important. You know, we can ask people to come to consultations or engagements, but frankly, actually, you know, it's not just young people, but a whole raft of people out there who don't feel comfortable coming into those spaces, wouldn't know what to say in those spaces. And sometimes with the Livable Neighbourhoods programme, it can get quite polarised. You know, we try to do engagements in a way that reduces conflict, but actually, you know, you are walking into a room where you have quite often hostile people who feel that actually the status quo is how it should be and actually how it was always been. So I think, you know, coming out of this, we are actually, I'm still listening. You know, when people say to me, well, actually, how are we going to engage with young people? It is very much for me still listening to, you know, listening to young people's voices. But what I would also say is that when you do talk to them, the contribution is, I don't have to say this, it sounds pretty patronising, is absolutely amazing. So we did a climate panel to try and make sure we had a representative voices across Islington, which had young people in it and had people who don't normally come. And the contributions were so valuable. And it just reinforces the absolute need to get different voices in and get young people's voices in. So I'd very much like to say thank you. I look forward to hearing more today and answering questions. But as I say, this is a piece of work that will be ongoing for us.
Thank you so much. And now we'll hear from the London-wide perspective from Mette. I'm curious why youth important is important for London's green transition from your perspective, how the Mayor of London's working to open up space for young people in green policy making, and where there's work to be done.
Yeah. Good afternoon, everyone. thank you. Look, let me firstly start by taking the opportunity to thank the LSE for putting forward such an important discussion around young people, particularly leading this conversation around how we can make sure we achieve climate justice for Londoners and how we reshape London, not just being a place to live to work, but actually being a place where people really enjoy their public space. But also thank you to Islington. I used to be a Hackney councillor, so it's going to hurt me when I say this, but actually Islington, in many ways, I have to be non-biased now to all London boroughs, but Islington in many ways is setting the example for London on how we really tackle the climate crisis, but also actually working with residents. And actually some of that thought leadership work, the work you're doing with young people around the sort of peer research, is so, so important. But also thank you to Manya and everyone else as well who's been involved in this project as well. I think it's really exemplary for the whole of London, lots for us to learn. So let's give a massive round of applause to all three partners, please. Look, Manya's already touched on this, and I think, you know, I always say this to people, like, I make no secret of it. I don't really come from a traditional environmentalist background. Actually, partly the reason why I grew to care about this issue, partly is because it's very much an issue of social justice, racial justice, but economic justice. I come from a community in Hackney where it's a very trendy and hipster place to live now. But actually, like Romina was saying, communities that have done the least to cause the climate crisis are those who are suffering the most from that. And what do I mean by that? I mean, when I used to go home and see my parents opening up their energy bills and see year on year end, see an increase in their energy prices because we're dependent on fossil fuels. And every time something happens around the world, who's paying more money for it? It's working class Londoners. Or the fact that I remember my first interaction with my GP doctor giving me an asthma pump, something I was really scared of. I remember looking at mum saying, "Mum, what the hell is this? What am I? What are you giving me to take to school with me at the age of 4 or 5? Because of an air quality crisis that we have, for something that those communities have done the least to cause, are suffering the most from the impacts of the climate and air quality crisis that we live in. So that's why it is an issue of social justice for us in London. It's about making sure, how do we use the green transition, which, by the way, is one of the biggest economic opportunities of the 21st century, as a way to think about how we could redistribute wealth to working class Londoners, and how do we actually make sure, I just got a 2-minute sign, oh my God, this is the problem of being a politician. It's like you can talk forever and ever and ever. Is how do you make sure that you actually deliver this in an equitable way where you can actually tackle some of the societal inequalities, the social inequalities that we have across our city, but also delivering the healthier outcomes. So for me, it's very much about how do we actually make the benefits of the transition much more tangible to communities? Because I think sometimes we talk about the climate crisis from a place of, you know, the doom and gloom. And of course we have to. We've got to think about the impact of extreme heat on our communities. We had flash floods in London in 2021, and we know that disproportionately impacted some of our most vulnerable communities. But actually there's huge opportunities and benefits that come with it, whether that's delivering much more energy efficient homes to save money on energy bills, whether it's cleaning our rivers. 41 of London's rivers are currently badly polluted. It's an absolute scandal, and we've normalised something that should never, ever, ever have been normalised. So how do we sort of correct that and actually clean our waterways across London? How do we create more access to green space, recognising that having access to green space for a lot of, or garden space for a lot of Londoners is a luxury, and actually how do we create good public green spaces? Again, recognising that residents who live in areas where it's badly polluted or have a lack of access to green space can't just say, not everyone has the luxury to say, hey, by the way, I don't like this area, so therefore I'm going to go off and rent somewhere else, or I'm going to go buy a property somewhere else. This is actually, you know, most people don't have that choice. And so for us, it's about making sure that London is a city where we have better access to air quality, you know, more energy efficient homes, cleaner air. I've been told to wrap up as well. But it's about really making the benefits of the green transition much more tangible. And look, the final thing that I would just say, 30 seconds, I'll be very quick, is the role that young people have to play and in shaping the future of our city. Something that both myself and the mayor is very, very, very passionate about. Next week for London Climate Week, we're going to be hosting the first ever Youth Climate Summit in London. It's going to be the start of a process where how we look at much more deliberative forms of engagement for how we can engage young Londoners in shaping policies that are coming directly out of City Hall. I really want to make sure it's not just tokenistic where we're just talking about things, but actually it's backed by a process of how they can influence some of the budgetary decisions that we make from City Hall as well. And I really look forward to being part of this conversation on how we could work together. So thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, and thanks to all our speakers. I guess I'd like to build on what you've all said about the question of social and economic justice being central to this, and to come back to some of Manya's points, and also to a moment in a focus group when one of the young people turned to us and said, climate awareness and being able to talk about the green transition is a privilege. The young people who we were sitting with were worried about mental health, worried about cost of living, worried about violence, safety on the streets. And I guess the question is, how should the green transition be talked about and framed in a way that invites diverse groups of young Londoners in? I don't know who'd like to start, or would you like to go first, maybe?
Yeah.
I can see him.
Look, I think often it's language barriers, isn't it? Like, as I say, I think often, you know, like the climate crisis is very much linked to the issues around, you know, your energy prices and cost of living, or like food prices as a result of the energy prices. Like, it's linked to so many different issues that actually affect Londoners' day-to-day lives. I think the problem is like, as I say, I reflect on myself, like from my journey and how I got into politics. I don't really see, like when people say to me about the environment, it was very much not really on the top of my agenda, partly because it's like, it's spoken about in a language that doesn't really appeal to Londoners. The other thing is, Manya made a really good point, actually. It's about people who look and sound from those communities actually leading those conversations. I often, you know, I'm the youngest ever deputy mayor of London. I'm 32. I'm also a person of colour as well. I'm from a community who's been more impacted by climate crisis. But actually, most of the rooms that I find myself in, I'm probably one or two of the only one who comes from a similar class background to me, who's leading that conversation. So the point I'm trying to make is we've got to have a much better effort in actually empowering Londoners from communities who can actually have these conversations in a much more powerful and impactful way. The only final thing that I would make a point as well is actually paying, like, I'm a strong believer in this, and I've done this in Hackney. When we were looking at extreme heat and the impact of extreme heat, councils and Rowena will notice as well, we have like these bald, old, statutory sort of like consultation methods of which, by the way, only the same residents, you only ever speak to the same residents, right? And actually, there's something about how do we actually compensate the time for Londoners who don't have the time to be part of a conversation to help shape our policy, because the reality is they're too busy either working, thinking about how they're going to put food on the table. And so if you want to actually have much more informed policy making, you've got to make sure that you actually compensate for the time or incentivize the time for some of those for some of our most marginalized groups who may not necessarily be involved in this conversation. So I think part of it is around the language barriers, and it's about education. And part of it is about the privilege point, which is that, unfortunately, we're all very lucky. We're all sat here talking about this issue. There are so many people out there right now outside of these walls who are actually focused on actually their day-to-day living, who don't have time to be part of these conversations. So the question is, how do we reach them? And also, how do we do that in a way that isn't just always in a setting like this? And that's the thing that I've done with My Life, My Say. was we were working with non-conventional partners like Tinder. So when we were thinking about vote registration, you were swiping left or right to register to vote. So it's about, the approach was, rather than bringing people to us, it's about going to where they go to in their day-to-day social and digital lives and think about how you can connect with them.
Mm. That's good to hear. That resonates with a lot of the findings that were coming out of the report, and also the principles in which we were doing this research of making sure that we were paying participants and we employ the young researchers as consultants on the project, which was a fundamental principle from the beginning. And do you feel like this resonates with your experience, mm-hmm. Manya?
Thank you. So I feel like this is something that's really important to young people, is making these links. So regarding the cost of living crisis, the unemployment, so many different factors are affecting young people, and I think it's important to make those links apparent to the green transition, to climate justice as a form of wider social, economic, and also racial justice. I've been transparent, like when I joined this project, I didn't necessarily feel like it's something that I could do, not because of my intellect or anything like that. It's mainly to Mete's point of like coming into rooms and not seeing people like myself being not just like a part of the discussion as a token, but actually co-designing things and also leading it. So I think it's good to see, this is an amazing first step, but I would love to see other initiatives follow this, follow our path of leading by example and working with young people to make those links more apparent to the green transition.
Mm. And Rowena, have you found that the framing of livable neighbourhoods has helped you when you're talking about the green transition and helped you try and make it feel more concrete to people's everyday lives?
Yes, but also there is a real, it's not just to in the way you talk about it, it's actually how you do it. So one of the things we hear a lot from young people is about how they don't feel safe necessarily in areas. And I was talking to somebody who was saying that, you know, they would be quite happy to cycle for about 90% of their journey, but actually that last 10%, that just meant they didn't do it. Mm. And I think, you know, and often that could be infrastructure. So that could be cycle lanes. It could be just quieter streets. It could be the traffic regulation of low traffic neighbours. But it also could be how that area feels. And I think it's really important for us to take that and listen to it, but also to talk to young people about what it is that makes them safe. What is it that makes them feel, if they go into a space, what is it that makes them unsafe? What can we do to make that better? And I've always said to, you know, our Livable Neighbourhood programme is a massive evolution. Mm. So we're looking at we've just gone out to consultation on the Annette Road Livable Neighbourhood. And actually, a very, very large part of that is to try and make that area feel more welcoming and feel more safe, because local people have said to us, actually, it doesn't, you know, there are bits of it with antisocial behaviour, and it's how we do that, but it's how we build what makes young people feel safe into it. I mean, we are doing an awful lot of work on trying to engage communities. So when we're doing again the Net Road, there will be organisations and schools and young people and local people we hope will look after those spaces, because that's what we know makes a difference to a community space. It's people's involvement. But again, you're going out and talking to those people that you can kind of reach. So it's easy to reach something through an organisation who probably will have more reach into our different communities, different voices. But it's how do you bring everybody in, and how do you make everybody feel they can kind of walk off the street and be part of that? And I think we're still struggling with that, I think.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, we've got a very full room here in London, so I wonder if we should turn to the audience now. I've got a few more questions which we can come back to next if you need a bit more time, but... Can I have a show of hands maybe for who has got a question ready for us already? We've got a roving mic. Okay, I'll take three at once. So, yeah, we've got one here.
My name is Rino Siconolfi. I'm MBA at LSI. I live in London since 8 years in Tower Hamlets. And I have to affirm that London administration is using the green transition in the best way to improve the accessibility to the green areas. I think that one of the questions that the young people feel more through the access to the green area is the safety and security. I wanted to understand how are the projects, especially connected with the most advanced new technologies, about to improve the safety and security to the green area using the green transition.
Okay, can we take two more? Over here.
Oh, hi. Yeah, the question I have is, what will sustainable sensibilities mean to the next generation?
Great. Shall we take one more? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hi. I'm interested in knowing what digital innovations or things like social media have influenced this process or their role in getting to young people, and if you've had experience with working with these platforms.
Great. Okay, so that was a mix. I guess maybe that last one was very concrete about digital tools, but we also had one about what is the sensibility of young people, and then looking more practically at London Street as well. I don't know. Yeah, Mette, do you want to start us off with?
Yeah, I'll be very brief. So look, I think absolutely, you know, London is very green. Over 51% of London is green. It's a very green city, particularly if you compare it to other cities around the world. But, you know, Rowena's point, practically at a very local level, we also know that there are issues around, you know, we've got to really respond to particularly people's feelings. We also know, for example, when you look at violence against women and girls has been on an increase in recent years. And we have a responsibility to make sure that where we are improving infrastructure to create these spaces, people obviously feel safe in lots of different ways. And there are lots of different partnership working between agencies, including the police, the local authorities, London government, other agencies as well, to make sure that, you know, be it around sort of some of the street signage, you know, listening to communities around, for example, where we could create more lighted areas, for example, where people feel more safe. You know, how we sort of manage some of the more bench, all of those things are into consideration, and each of the local authorities will be leading on a strategy around that. On your question specifically around the digital engagement, is the point I was trying to make, which is, if you are thinking about, when I used to do work around getting young people engaged in politics, firstly, the question is wrong, because the assumption is that all young people are this one big homogenous group. And actually, there's lots of different intersectionalities, and there's lots of different ways you can reach young people, depending on sort of the geographic area, what sort of their interests are, etc., etc. So I think when you are setting out for engagement on policy making, you've got to really, firstly, you've got to have a multi-layered approach. There's no one-size-fits-all approach. So I actually, where I find digital engagement most strongest is where it complements some of the face-to-face engagement that you can have around policy making, because sometimes you can never really beat the feeling of looking you in the eye and actually really understanding and getting that sort of feedback from you. We've had really good engagement, particularly around sort of, and one of the areas we're looking at is the introduction of AI around nature-based solutions across our city. I'm not sure people may know this or may not know this as well, but we reintroduced beavers back to London after 400 years. First beaver's name is Justin Beaver. and beavers have a huge role to play in terms of flood resilience. They build natural dams to protect themselves from wolves, which they're scared of, but obviously these dams play a huge role in terms of flood resilience across our city as well. And some of the nature-based solutions and the technology that we've been able to use there has been able to inform how we make sure that we get the right types of species or trees in, for example, particularly around the public realm, is really important, and those sorts of things are, and that equity point is really important as well. And your question was about what does young people you're going to have to ask the next generation that question. Probably from Wanya.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What does it mean to feel sustainable, I suppose? Is that yeah, what kind of a sensibility would make you feel like you're being sustainable in your time? That's a hard question. You can start with the easy ones that Mette took. you can start with maybe reflecting a bit on the kind of digital and online engagement, and what do you think works?
I feel like going to the question about digital engagement, our research indicates that young people, they do want to have social media engagement. So TikTok came up a lot in our research. However, young people also said they really want to have in-person events, so they'd like to have more of a hybrid approach moving forward. Back to Mateo's point. And I think to your question about sustainability moving forward, that's quite a privileged thing to think about, I think, for young people. So, like, there's lots of, like, conflicting things going on at the moment, like cost of living crisis, the rise of unemployment, trying to, like, find a decent place to live that's not nearly all of your, like, monthly salary as well. So I think it's trying to convey the message to young people that the green transition and climate justice do directly link to those things. So trying to make those, I guess, like, abstract or lofty ideals of, like, what is the green transition, like, making it more palatable and accessible to young people. I'm not sure if that's fully answered your question, but yeah.
So I think there is a real tension between, you know, the pressures that young people are feeling and actually what we're actually asking people to be part of. And it sometimes feels quite hard because, you know, I can absolutely go out there and quite rightly say, look, if you have a green, attractive street where you feel safe, where you can get together and talk to your neighbours and you can mix, that has a massive impact on your health and well-being.
Yeah.
But actually, at the same time, if someone's worried about being evicted or someone worried about not paying for their rent, then it kind of feels a bit like, well, yes, you can say that, but who are you to tell me that yeah, you know, this is better for you? But on the other hand, I think there's also something about how you can use it to make people feel better. And also the point that I think you were making slightly is also how are you contributing to making something sustainable? So we know you can make sort of lifestyle choices like what you eat and what you and you know, how you travel around. But actually, if you can be part of something that can change your local environment, that will have a difference. And people say, well, no, what would a pocket park do? Well, actually, pocket park does a lot for a community, but actually one pocket park does one thing. But if you have 10 pocket parks, you have 100 pocket parks, you know, across London, and I know the appetite is there from the Mayor of London, you as an individual can completely change, help be part of what is changing London. So I think there's that. In terms of sort of digital, I think I had this really interesting conversation at the launch with some young people about that. And it's right, it seems to be that there is a real mixed approach. And they've talked about things like, if you're going to use social media, actually you should be using an influencer. Because if you can get an influencer to follow you, for example, then that has a massive impact. But also there are type of events, that free events usually, that young people will go to that they'll be interested in. And if you can go to that space and you can find a way of talking to young people in that space, that actually is quite powerful as well. So it's not... And they were also saying that, you know, in that space, it doesn't actually matter who's talking to them. As long as they're being treated respectfully, they've got the information they want, and they're allowing to be part of that conversation. So, you know, I did say, well, it shouldn't be really someone like me, should it? And, you know, and someone came back, well, actually, it can be someone like you, as long as the conversation you're having with us is about being respectful. So, there's an awful lot to learn. I came away from a number of these engagements with, thank gosh, there's an awful lot to learn.
Yeah, and I think sometimes being able to even just acknowledge how complicated it is and how hard it is for the green transition policy to address these systemic challenges, but keeping that as a conversation on the table and not having green policy in an isolation, it seemed like something that came out pretty strongly in our report. I'm going to turn to Anthony now, who's my colleague in the room, who is collecting online questions. Have you got
three for thank me? You. Hello, everyone. So, three questions. One, what role can schools and universities play in amplifying the voices of young people besides through research? Question two, how do we make sure that green projects don't end up pushing out the people that they're meant to help? And third, a question touching on what's just been talked about. What impact, if any, does the housing crisis and the difficulty of finding a stable home have on young people's engagement on issues like climate change?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Three great questions. I don't know, should we go to you again, Mehdi?
Yeah, look, the final question, I'll just say, is very much linked to the climate crisis. And I say this is like, we have a big programme. So, in London right now, you have a huge issue with buildings, particularly old social housing buildings not being basically ready for the sort of the extreme heat that we face across our city. We also have a huge crisis, by the way. I say that as someone who whose parents still live in social housing and have grown up in social housing around damp and mould, and you know the condition around social housing across our city. And we have a huge responsibility to think about actually how do we, you know, think about energy efficiency across our city. So one of the things that we set up recently is something called Warmer Homes London. Now, council housing is managed by councils, the local authorities and the council in London. But the problem with that is two things, and I won't bore you with it. The first one is you've got a really bizarre system which creates this bidding wars between councils to bid for money from government, to get money to do work around retrofit, which helps improve energy efficiency and actually making sure that residents don't have to make a choice between heating and eating during particularly winter time. And then the second problem is most councils, as I say, are dealing with a huge housing crisis when it comes to the maintenance of social homes, repairs, particularly a backlog since the pandemic as well. And so what we've done is we set up something called Warmer Homes London, essentially where we lead a consortium bid for London. We've been able to unlock £232 million from government to improve energy efficiency for around 22,000 homes. That also links to, you know, it links to tackling fuel poverty, making sure that we've got the right skills around retrofit across our city. So you can actually, you know, whilst you're actually helping improve energy efficiency and dealing with like the remedial works that need to happen across our homes and our estates across London, you can also help improve the environmental objectives as well around the climate crisis. So I think that's a clear example around retrofit where, you know, you can involve people around that conversation. And where this will really work, and the final thing I'll just say on this point is how you involve Londoners to be part of that conversation. And then the final thing I'll just say on the schools point is schools for us and universities are really important hubs where we can get this conversation going, partly because you've got access to loads of young people. And one of the things that we've been doing is going back to that point about delivering tangible benefits is we launched something called Greener Schools, which is basically retrofitting our school estates across our city, solar PV, air source heat pumps. We can save up to schools £15,000 per year on their energy bills that they can otherwise use for activities for children, could use for, you know, whatever it is that they want to use, whilst at the same time helping support our environmental objectives. Now, if you think about carbon emission saving, it's not really going to move the world in terms of like some of the interventions we're making. But what it does is if you think about schools and universities being, you know, in many ways it's so important for communities, it's a catalyst for conversations for how you actually can engage the community around the climate conversation. I remember my mum, who took me, my older brother who's 6 years older than me, and my younger sister who's 6 years younger than me, to the same school for 18 years. She said to me, oh, I'm going to the school to talk about solar panels. This is like 2 years ago. I'm like, mum, you're going to the school to talk about solar panels. Like, my sister left school years ago. Why are you going to the school? And she, by the way, she's someone who can't speak English as well. But she feels like she's got a personal interest in that school because she's been going there for 18 years and she wants to be a part of the conversation around any investment they're making around the schools around solar panels. That, for me, was like a massive wake-up call because it was like, wow, even my mum, who's someone who, you know, immigrant to this country, can't speak English, you know, used to work in a textile firm, doesn't work now, didn't really engage in the community in no way, is going to the school to talk about solar panels. And it was a way of like actually bringing the community together. So the point I'm trying to make is there are smart initiatives that we can make around schools, which I can think could be a part of a wider conversation around not just the school itself, but around the neighbourhood.
Great, that resonates definitely with schools as focal hubs. What do you think, Manya, in terms of some of those questions? I mean, we had one about housing, which was obviously a huge theme in our conversations with young people, and pushing out young people people who the green transition is meant to help.
I'll quickly go to the first question and come back to that. Okay. So I feel like schools and education, like, this is something that's a really important topic, so we should be making use of this. So like starting from like early on, from like primary schools to secondary to universities, or if they go to colleges, so introducing like gardening classes, but having that like as a mandatory part of the curriculum, or like something along those lines, so young people understand from like a very early age the importance of like having a green space, and also like being in the green spaces, like what does it feel like to them to like actually be outside and like having those experiences? Because I feel like young people but it's been taken away, like those experiences, and so really making that a part of the curriculum is something that I'd suggest.
Great. Well, we can also go on to
I mean, that's a really important point. And if you live in London, you've lost that connection with the soil in many cases. And I remember talking to one of the people who work with a garden classroom, who work with young people in our schools, and there sometimes it takes them 20 to 30 minutes to get a young person to touch the soil because they seem it's dirty. Yet when you do, and you see young children interacting with nature, it's just an amazing experience. It's one of these really sort of heartwarming experiences, particularly those who are kind of surprised. Children themselves are quite surprised, and it's delightful. I mean, I think again, thank you, Mette. I think you've got five schools that are benefiting from that that scheme. But it's absolutely important to find ways of engaging, and actually with schools and with young people, talk. That for us is one of the reasons we went for it. Absolutely, it does really help with energy bills. It's really important for the environment, but also it is about how you enable schools to start talking to young people. About it in a way that is tangible to them, and that's another reason why I'm quite keen on sort of community power as well.
Yeah,
because you're getting, you know, you're enabling conversations to happen that aren't necessarily going to happen through other means. I think in terms of
define community power for people.
Where you have sort of almost community organisations who find ways of raising money to put on buildings. So, for example. I'm talking tonight at Power Up North London, who works with places, but also schools, to raise money to put solar panels on the roof. And they do it, and they go out to the community, and they get the money. And they've got an amazing community centre,
so
Caxton
important.
House, up in Islington. So, yeah, so I think there's that. In terms of being pushed out, I think to be honest with you, you know, if you're talking about Islington, young people are being pushed out just because the housing market and the rental system is completely broken. But it is obviously a concern. But as I say, I think that is a very much deeper issue. I mean, I don't think we could... I think it's very hard to say, actually, we can't improve your streets, we can't improve your air quality, because it may have some consequence. Well, all we can do is try and do something to mediate those. And as I say, you know, really try and tackle the housing crisis. And actually the way the rents are allowed to increase at the moment is just, unfortunately, it's a bit of above the playground. We do what we can to increase our housing stock, but essentially that's a bit, and it's not.
We need rent freeze.
Rent controls came up a huge amount. There were actually times when we said, what does the word livable mean to you? Yeah. And someone came back immediately with rent controls, because obviously there's a conversation about that in London now. Yeah. And another moment in a focus group that what you're saying reminds me of was when one young girl said, sure, I'd really like a bench, I'd like more greening, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but I also want to be able to afford to live here. So it's just kind of like holding those two things at once is what's really challenging in these conversations, because actually, yeah, both of those things do have value and young people understand that. Okay, we're coming to time a little bit, but I wonder if we have time for maybe... I don't know, could we do... Have you got more questions from online, or should we do... Oh, there's lots of hands in the room.
There's hands.
All right, let's do... Should we take maybe two in the room and a third online, if you've got one online? There's three at the back there. Maybe you, the closest, or whether... Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so one of the questions that's been going on in my mind is about how we are incentivizing the youth to contribute or to feel like they have done something better, especially when the public transportation costs are so high. Nobody wants to wake up at 2 a.m. and see that they have been switched off £8 just for traveling through zone 1 and 2. Now the thing is, you are squeezing them through the ULEZ, you're squeezing them through public transportation. And this is a government-owned department. Is the government, or is there any other body that is planning to make public transportation more affordable, especially since AQI and fossil fuels are the major problem in a city-based environment? So what exactly are we doing?
That's one more. Oh, maybe the hand's gone down. Oh, this over there, yeah.
I live in a council estate in Islington, actually, Rowena. There is a huge difference. It's like night and day between people that own their property and people that are council renters. Yeah, few people are known. So, I mean, I go into my neighbour's house, who doesn't own, and there's the mould, his roof's falling in and everything, and he's always waiting for the council, waiting for the council. But I'll ask him, oh, you know, why don't you paint that? Why don't you tidy that? He doesn't have any motivation to make his own place nice because he doesn't feel like he owns it. I think that even applies even more when you think about the natural environment. If you don't feel you own, like, outside of your house, why would you want to take care of it? I mean, you can think of, like, dropping litter as, like, the most obvious example. I'm not going to drop litter in my house, but I don't drop litter, by the way. Someone might not drop it in the house, but they might drop it outside because they don't own outside, okay? They don't feel they have any responsibility. And I know you talked a bit about engagement or involvement, Marina, and it works in other cities like New York. How do we give ownership of outside spaces to people and just trust them that they will take care of it?
Great. And then one more from the online audience, please. Thanks for running around.
So I'm paraphrasing this slightly, but it comes from, I think, someone in Taiwan. And they wanted to know a little bit more about how the research project worked. Like, how did you reach out to people? How did you collect their opinions? What sort of methods were you using for discussion? Things like that.
Great. Well, Manny, I guess you're best placed to pick up that last one. Or you can pick up whatever you heard before as well.
So regarding the research methods, we had a survey that was sent out across the borough. We worked with partners in Islington Council to push out the survey, as well as, like, pushing out in our own networks. And we also had focus groups as well. So we went to places where young people were, so like the Arsenal Football Club, or there's this community, like, youth green space near King's Cross. So we went to places where young people were to hear about them. We tried to frame the questions to be pretty accessible, so that it wasn't too filled with, like, technical jargon. It was just trying to have a conversation, like, young person to young person. Like, what do you really feel about the borough that you're in? Like, what are your experiences moving around it? And what can, like, we as a council, like, what can we do better to, yeah, like, make our communities better as well, really.
And I guess that point about it being conversations-led, young person to young person, is an important one, because we were using peer research from the beginning, which is when we built a team, basically, with policymakers and with young people themselves. So we've designed everything from the research questions to the methods to the outputs. So it was like a collaborative kind of a collaborative experiment, the whole thing, but I think it's come together in exciting ways. Do you want to?
Yeah. So perhaps I could take your. So I don't think it's quite as bleak as you paint it, because you know, there are many people who are involved in things outside their community. I mean, for example, I don't have any outside space, but I plant out my tree pits and I garden in one of the parks, and I kind of do it primarily because it makes me happy. But I also know that it makes other people happy, because when I'm sort of like digging, I'm a rubbish gardener, but, you know, when I'm planting, people come up to me and say, actually, you know, well, I walk past this every day, and it you know, and that really lifts me. And actually, we have amazing engagement in our parks and on some of our housing estates, including, you know, I just went to a couple of ones in Barnsbury, where they've been working with the community gardening team, where the community gardening team go in and they work with residents to look after their spaces. And that's had an amazing effect on the community. But, you know, you ask a very good question, is how do you feel people feel they're empowered to do that? And actually, on our streets, that is a different question. So, you know, people will do some tree pits, but that's, and it's a question we're really, really asking ourselves now, and we're really working on. So Matt, who's the head of our transport planning programme, the Livable Neighbourhoods programme over there, I mean, he's working, you know, with the sort of the green space team, who have much more experience of engagement. But not just them, the partners that they've been working with over the years. So those community groups who can go out and start empowering, feeling that I'm empowering other people. So it is a question of empowerment. You're absolutely right. the council, sometimes there is this little bit of a tension between actually, well, actually, you know, if we do let people do this, what does it mean? But it is actually a journey we're on, and a journey we need to be on, frankly.
Yeah, we're pretty much coming to time, but Mathieu, maybe we have a moment for you to give a last word, something on...
Yeah, I'll just say, like, there's something really interesting about this quote, the point you made around ownership and the question that's being asked in this session here today. Because actually, this is about, you know, like, I always say to people, like, one of the things that got me really interested in politics was, I remember when I was growing up, the one thing that I think we had that we don't have as much now is a sense of belonging in your community, a sense of ownership of your community, of your neighbourhood. I remember, for example, my youth club that I used to go to every single day from 4 to 9 o'clock, because my parents will be working late, open for 35 years, serving hundreds of boys and girls from immigrant working class backgrounds in any single day, shut down one day because of a decision that a government took in 2010. And the sense that I felt of feeling angry, the fact that no one lifted their finger, and overnight, all those kids who depended on that youth club, that all the co-benefits that youth club brought, just had nowhere to go to, and there was no form of engagement. I actually think there's a huge opportunity through the green transition. It's around, and that's the message that we all got to take away, which is around Londoners, young Londoners, need to be much more demanding and saying, hey, to people like me, to people like Rowena, is saying, you're here serving us. What are you doing to co-produce, co-design? This shouldn't just be Sadiq Khan's mission for London, Mete Koban's mission for London. If you really want to get people's buy-in to actually look after their outdoor green spaces, if you work together with them on doing it, you're more likely to get people actually looking after their streets because you've actually worked with them. They feel like it's their project. That's why the community energy model that Rowena was talking about is so, so important. Next week, we're going to be announcing a new nature fund in London, which is all around giving the seeds to Londoners to go out and green their neighbourhoods. And it's all around this question of ownership. So I think, you know, those are absolutely the right questions that we should be asking.
Brilliant. Well, unfortunately, we have to wrap up now. I'd love to continue this, but I will say one last thing is that we will be continuing this conversation on the 22nd of July when we're launching the report, and we'll have all four young researchers there, so you can talk to them directly about what they found through this project. I hope that many of you can attend. Thank you again to everyone here.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.